So the topic I want to address tonight, which is a topic that is near my life, pretty much central to what I think about in life intellectually, is whether there is such a thing as a modern Orthodox approach to halakha. And if there is, and I think that Orthodoxy revolves around halakha, it's not exclusively halakhic, the whole debate whether Orthodoxy should be as halakha focused as it is, but pretty much, you know, what makes the life, Orthodox life revolves around is halakha. And so if you want to have a distinctive approach within Orthodoxy, it seems like that should affect the way in which you do halakha. So is there such a thing as a modern Orthodox approach to halakha?
Just before we start, when you say halacha, you mean halachic actions, not, in other words, not halachas of hashkafa.
I'm not thinking about how you make halachic decisions. That may be that one of the issues is whether you think that theological issues are subject to halacha. That may itself be something that makes modern Orthodoxy distinctive. And you can also, you know, make somewhat cynical sociological claims about what modern Orthodox approach to halakha are. I want to take it on a really intellectual approach, right? If you identify yourself as modern Orthodox, does that contribute something to the way in which you think about what you ought to do and how halakha ought to be decided? And I'm going to start with it. I think it ought to. But the really interesting question after that, and once you ought to, is does it affect what you think procedurally? Do you think about halakha in a different way? Or does it just mean that you bring different assumptions to the table? Right, that you would try and justify the practices of your community as opposed to the practices of a different community. Now, my window into that, so I'm going to give, it's very much not a classic London chair tonight, so you don't have to need any Hebrew really to get through tonight's chair. I'm not trying to demonstrate a case in sources. What I want to do is take the topic of brain death, which probably any of you who are active in the Orthodox web know has been a matter of great controversy in the past 30 years, really, but once again because of the RCA paper that came out. And what I want to talk about is not what I think the halakhic outcome ought to be, but I want to take two different statements that were issued on the subject, one of which from a very validly modern Orthodox perspective, one of which from a very validly non-modern Orthodox perspective, and read them for what they say about the way they think about halakha, and then analyze them together. Are the positions that they take about halakha, are they what you think typical of modern Orthodox? Are they what you want to identify with? Is it, you know, I'd rather peculiar that we actually put pressure on people making reverse decisions from what their community's specific actually claim when they're making programmatic statements? Along the way, if you're interested in asking questions about brain death per se, I'm happy to talk about it, although I have hedged my bets. I'm going to find out what I really think Sunday night, so I keep on going back and forth myself. What I want to do is really just read these two documents and try to analyze them as, like, for the new halakhic content. What do they say about halakha as opposed to what do they say about brain death? So the two statements are as follows. A little bit of background history should be aware that some years ago, the Rabbinical Council of America, the RCA, issued a statement through its Medical Ethics Commission, which I think was largely created to issue that statement, in which it adopted some version of brain death as halakhically viable, so that you could battle the will and you could legitimately donate your organs after brain death. It was done in the Halakhic Commission, which might reasonably have been, I don't remember, 20 years ago, it's my size, I'm not sure exactly. The Halakhic Commission, this was done straightforwardly as an end run around the Halakhic Commission. And the Halakhic Commission of Dubai Halakha, the RFDA, later voted 42 with one abstention against this movement, but for organizational politics it became the standard RFDA approach was this medical proxy, even though the halakha of the RFDA was opposed to it. After however many years of waiting, this year the sub-Dubai Halakha finally put out a 113-page paper, which set out the case against brain death, although it did not make the halakhic ruling, it just made clear that it thought that the arguments that had been made in the past for brain death were not compelling. In response to that, Chavad Dublin, the Rosh Yeshiva Yeshivat Chodesh Vesara, wrote a petition which he intended to rally public halachic support for the original RCA stock accepting brand, which was also the stock of the Rebbe Dovra Sheikh in Israel. In response to that, Agudat Yisrael put out an anonymous statement in Ahmadiyya attacking Rebbe Linzer's petition. And I want to look at the Rebbe Linzer's petition and their good response. Now, the controversy here is there's a lot of really vicious rhetoric on both sides of the issue. In this particular case, we'll talk about Rebbe Linzer's rhetoric is not vicious, although we still have to talk about whether it's temperate. And their good statement, I think, is not the kind of statement that I would like to see engaged in the normal of nor developing discourse, but until we have, we're going to play with it. Okay, so here's the rest of some appendix A in the religious system. I want to read it just closely, right? Imagine that it's an Aramaic. Okay, so you can take it seriously. Okay, the religion begins by saying, we the undersigned Orthodox rabbis in Rosh Yeshiva, so now we notice about that.
Orthodox,
certainly, right? So we have to, because if you don't say Orthodox, then you lose credibility in the part of Orthodox community right immediately. And if you don't make it an Orthodox position, this I started writing about last week. What does it mean to have a self-identified? One of the interesting things about Orthodoxy right now is that Orthodoxy is a movement self-identifies itself as the sole legitimate representative of the halakhic tradition. So you have to include anyone who is not identified as Orthodox in a halakhic statement is to diminish your credibility as opposed to increase it now. I think that's the correct... I actually have a friend of mine who's sort of a borderline, formerly conservative rabbi and wanted to know if he could sign on or not. Because he wasn't sure what the standards are. I have no idea either. And I should say I haven't signed this yet. But to relate to the first thing I wrote, what else do you notice about it?
Does
Rosh Yeshiva need to be a rabbi? Does Rosh Yeshiva in addition to rabbis? Okay. Which means Rosh Yeshiva are not rabbis.
They're not necessarily
rabbis. Right, not necessarily rabbis. So what do you think the purpose of the state? What does rabbis mean then?
Not only do we have rabbis, we have Rosh Yeshiva. That's what I'd say. In other words, you have your Rosh Yeshiva, and we have our Rosh Yeshiva.
So let's take a look at statement B now, and watch the statement B in the first paragraph says the rabbinic statement regarding organization defined by several scores, quote, Orthodox rabbis in Rosh Yeshiva is decidedly unorthodox in its approach. And the second paragraph begins the statement signed by congregational on campus rabbis and chaplains.
Okay,
so you can see up front that
there's no Rosh Yeshiva. Like, no people, I guess Rosh Yeshiva as opposed to, like, the show rabbi. Like, the show rabbi is the person who deals with, like, the Balabatim, like, the general populace, and the public government is, like, really scholarly, gathering text.
That is right. So I think what's going on here is that, I do exactly get it right. The claim we have Rosh Yeshiva, right, that's the claim of legitimacy. It's not just synagogue rabbis. It's also Rosh Yeshiva, and that claim is in fact immediately countered by Agudah, because if in fact you could claim you have Rosh Yeshiva, then you're a legitimate dispute. So they have to claim now. I have to say that, on the fact, it's really quite astounding that Agudah would say this, because aside from his injury, you can have your fights about Chofei Torah if you want.
He's
Rosh Yeshiva Chofei Torah, so they're not going to count with Chofei Torah. But the first thing is, even if they want to take their fights about Chofei Torah, they can have their fights about Chofei Torah, I guess. But the biggest story underneath were the Rosh Yeshiva of his Hezer Yeshiva, Tetzav Tikva and Malik Gilboa. So you had to exclude a lot of yeshivas in order to make the claim that it was just congregational rabbis and chaplains. What I'm interested in is, so I think what happened here is Rabbi Linzer is appealing to that audience, right? So he says rabbis and Rosh Yeshiva because he's implicitly accepting the sociological claim that you need to have Rosh Yeshiva in addition to rabbis. And it doesn't work because it just disqualifies Rosh Yeshiva. But what do you think, right? Do you think, like, in your life, right, if you think about halakha, right, does it matter to you? Do rabbis have more authority than Rosh Yeshiva? Do Rosh Yeshiva have more authority than rabbis? And is this a unorthodox as opposed to a sort of the issue? Okay, here's Shani.
Orthodoxy in general tends to have, for example, on the Grand Rift campus, for example, you have like a few communities and movements other than Orthodox communities where there are communities that are coming to get dressed and being oriented in like a very way, like spend time, you know, before college in indoor settings, things like that. But overarchingly, there's an emphasis within the Orthodox world on serious Torah study and where it's like. And so if you're going to have the unity as coming from an Orthodox standpoint, it's something that, you know, largely rabbis in non-Orthodox settings are congregational or campus settings. Rabbis in Orthodox settings can have more of a learning connotation. So if you wanted to put yourself on that, in that camp, and put yourself also in the camp of people oriented towards halakhic defensiveness, I would say, people who are interested in engaging in moving through the halakhic process,
you're talking about Rosh Yeshiva because you're
the one focusing on the learning aspect.
Interesting. So you buy, even in modern Orthodoxy, Rosh Yeshiva has much more halakhic credibility than rabbis.
I don't know if I'm going to add that into it, but I mean, in the sense that that's a sociological reality, in the sense of whether it should be your reality.
So it's fine. On the scale, I fall on Rosh Yeshiva side, so I'm fine with it. Don't worry. What do you want to say, Jacob?
The question, like, who has more legitimacy in our lives?
Yeah, you know, do you think that this is a, if you were to think, let's say, you know, if you identify non-Orthodox Jews, you would say, okay, let me pick the four people whose opinion matters to me halakhically. So how many of you are synagogue rabbis on that list? And how many of you are, how many of you guys do?
I don't know, because I can ask Rosh Yeshiva, but he's just in yeshiva all day, so I don't actually trust what he would say. You were totally opposite to follow what he said. You know what I mean?
I think that's a really important point. I mean, that I think a lot of, especially in circles using more of a Bala Tshuva, right, that like people don't, you know, their home synagogue and the synagogue that they wouldn't necessarily feel like philosophically, but they go away to yeshiva, and so they come away with like a whole host of teachers who they trust, you know, philosophically, because they affiliate with them more. So they're the people that they're going to go to with the halakhic problems, but in reality, those people are, like you just said, sitting in yeshiva all day and not like living with, like, living through the issues of other people.
And do you see this as a distinction between non-Orthodoxy and, let's say, Haredi Orthodoxy, or do you just see that as what ought to be, what is true, you know, what ought to be true? Yes, ma'am.
Isn't this difference of, like, practical versus, like, ideal?
Interesting.
Like, meaning, like, you're spiritual rabbi, like, me personally, I would turn Michael rabbi to something practical, because, like, he knows me and our community. And maybe some other, like, question I could turn to, like, my Rosh Yeshiva in Israel, but my Shul Rabbi is one that, like, knows me, like, in a certain context.
Interesting. Anything else you want to say?
I think it doesn't just talk about Orthodoxy. I think this Shul Rabbi versus Rosh Yeshiva is not quite the proper breakup you want to get into. You should be asked a lot of questions you should have relevant.
What is the good? Yeah.
I think there's a difference between rabbis who focus on the theoretical and rabbis who focus on practical stuff. Like this summer I had a halakhic shiva and went to a Rosh Kollel of a very non-modern Orthodox Kollel, and he eventually told me to go ask somebody else because like, you know what they do in Lakewood, but if you want to practice halakha, what's actually acceptable if you go somewhere else and if you just want to see, no, you're not allowed to do it.
Interesting. So I'll give you a number of things about this. One is you should be aware that Kol Vayikra was founded and largely around the claim that modern Orthodoxy should be about synagogue rabbis and not about Rosh Yeshiva, it's about decentralized authority. And part of the point of religious statement is I think that putting Rosh Yeshiva on was sort of a hesitant nod, because he would much rather have just been rabbis, but he felt he had to put Rosh Yeshiva on. Now this is part of a critique that many of you share, that thinks that Rosh Yeshiva are less in touch with people's lives than synagogue rabbis.
Another thing, it doesn't really break down that they would know more. Like, there's some rabbis who are more in touch with people's lives, but I mean, I guess it would depend on the, I don't know. I think in general, yeah.
But I have to say that, you know, this is something which I, to some degree, resist. People like to make this a boundary line between between modern Orthodoxy and Haredi Orthodoxy, and I'm open, I don't like it. Not just that it's open, it's my power, no. Go ahead, take a shul, I mean, for a number of reasons. First of all, I should say autobiographically, I never grew up in a shul. I never had a shul rabbi. But I did grow up next to YU. So, yeah, so my my biographical experience is I never knew a shul rabbi, I only knew Rosh Yeshiva. So, but I want to make, I also have experience as a, quote unquote, you know, as a non-shul rabbi who has to spend some time cleaning up after shul rabbi. But, I think that here's the first position I want to articulate, which is that I tend to think that people ask shaylos to the people whose answers they find most existentially useful. And therefore, if there has been a large shift from asking shaylos to your shul rabbi, asking shaylos to your Rosh Yeshiva, which is sociologically the case, that probably means the Rosh Yeshiva are giving better answers. It's an interesting question of whether the Rosh Yeshiva are giving, an interesting critique is whether the Rosh Yeshiva tend to give answers that work for students of a certain age, or whether they tend to give answers that work better for people who are more formally halakhically committed, because the students who stay in touch with them long term tend to be those students. Because Rosh Yeshiva can ignore the students who don't stay in touch with them, whereas shul rabbis can't, because they have responsibility. Shul rabbis have a constituency which is defined by something other than personal choice. Right? Their constituency is defined by geography. Right? Defined by institution. So it's an interesting question as to whether a psak defined by Rosh Yeshiva is likely to be more elitist than a shul rabbi psak. I'm not sure it has to be. I think the part of the dichotomy is false because, for example, let's say the great poskim in the non-Orthodox world, assuming you consider why you're part of the non-Orthodox world, which is, you know, it is at least on alternate Tuesdays. But most of the Rosh Yeshiva out there have shuls, so it's not like you have a list of Mordechai Willig, for example, who's been in the synagogue of the Yangishul Riverdale for many years. And so the notion that stock coming from him is Rosh Yeshiva stock as opposed to shul rabbi stock seems to me a little odd. So I'm telling you that one of the standard attempts, right, and Chovei Torah pushes this, to distinguish between Haredi stock and non-Orthodox stock is that Haredi stock is Rosh Yeshiva stock and non-Orthodox stock should be shul rabbi stock. But you should be aware of that. I tend to have significant resistance to that claim. I would much rather say it depends. If we have Rosh Yeshiva who paskin in the way that we can lead to the community, that's great. If we have shul rabbis who do, that's great. If we have shul rabbis who are great scholars, they should have more authority. And if we have Rosh Yeshiva who are great scholars, they should have the authority of scholars. If we have shul rabbis who are deeply in touch with their communities, then they should have more authority. And if we have Rosh Yeshiva who are deeply in touch, I'm not convinced that Rosh Yeshiva are necessarily cut off. I tend to think that shaylos are answered well by people who get lots of them. And that to some degree, you know, there's a balance. Shul rabbis may be too economically dependent on the local community to good friends. So I would rather resist that. But I want to be upfront, right, that Aguda is clearly taking a stance that it's supposed to be Rosh Yeshiva. Right? By the point, they have to go so far as to claim that, you know, the first five things written on the sheet who are all Rosh Yeshiva are quote unquote children, campus rabbis, I guess. I don't know if they're all Rosh Yeshiva campuses. Very peculiar. Okay. Alright, and so Reuven again, going back to what you said, and he says, first and foremost, the halachic definition of death is a long-standing debate amongst Gedolei HaPoskim. Gedolei HaPoskim is an interesting term also. Gedolei HaPoskim already assumes that stock is not entirely, distributed. It's not like all stock should be decided by shul rabbis on their own. There are major academic figures who are the Gedolei HaPoskim. So I think it's really interesting, and I think that most of us can sort of understand that things like the halakhic definition of death are not, it's not such a great idea to be totally decentralized. So you don't really like want people going from life to death as a transfer from hospital. depending on the criteria. This is great. And this is one of the challenges for people who advocate a decentralized halakha, is what about those things that require public policy, where it really doesn't work? And we'll talk about that at some point.
Just when it says Gedolei Poskim, I mean, some Gedolei Poskim advocated a kind of decentralized halakhic process a little bit. The Rav, in a certain sense, allowed for his members to be part of the New York Board of Rabbis, even though he didn't approve, right? I mean,
so I would say there are people, we'll talk, there are some people who want to make all the decisions centralized, if you want to make some of the decisions centralized, but there are very few people who really want complete decentralization.
Yeah, that's all I'm trying to
say. People love, or my wife loves credit authority, other people, I give you sleep, but you make up your mind, that's where my wife is, but I don't like his favorite story, but sometimes Rob didn't say that. Sometimes he said, I can't give sleep, and he never listened to me. It all depends on the issue. I don't have a story like that. Sharp didn't give me a sneeze, but I can't say anything of the sort. But I get the impression that, there were times that he was really unhappy with it, he just didn't call it. Okay. So they quote a number of people who are apparently qualified as Gilead Poskim, two of whom are unfortunately defeated, the former chief rabbi of Israel. And I would say here, one of the central disputes between Zionists and non-Zionists, Tzach. And here I think it's important to introduce the distinction between modern Orthodox Tzach and Zionist Tzach. And this is one of the real sociological issues our community is facing, is that because in America it lined up that modern Orthodoxy was Zionist and Greater Orthodoxy was generally not, and therefore modern Orthodoxy aligned with religious Zionism in Israel, but it doesn't actually work on issues other than Zionism right now. And that's really a big issue, that people assume there's an equation of the communities, but actually...
Right.
It turned out not to be true. So it turns out that people in Israel doesn't necessarily relate to modern Orthodoxy at all on any issue other than Zionism. And the truth is that Haredi in Israel doesn't equate to Haredi in America at all either. Because the Haredi community in Israel is much, much more insular, much less integrated, much more conservative than the Haredi community in America, such that if they actually ever met each other, they would be kind of shocked. So you have to be careful about statements like that. But one of the things is, you won't find in the Haredi journal, you won't find former chief rabbi of Israel listed as Gedolei HaPoskim. Right? So personalities make a difference, even though the former chief rabbis generally are Haredi by every measure except Zionism. But Zionism is really only issue separate, you still won't see them listed. Issues like that. Okay. I have Gregory Del Schwartz, the outside of the days in America, right over proposing to the position that brings them death counts as a halakhic definition of death. There are rumors flying about Del Schwartz. He didn't really say it, but I can tell you he did say it, but I spoke to him 3 weeks ago for 20 minutes. He really does say it. Okay. I wrote this for a tour, and a student from YU wrote me, I wish Schwartz didn't really do the research himself, he was just lying over 10 minutes. Right, so I know that there are
rumors.
I'm reading, but I'm just, so I called her, Schwartz. He answered my phone, he's a very nice man. Okay. So now, here's an interesting one. Those positions that brain stem death comes to death and that only cardiac death can define death are halakhically viable. That's an interesting language. What does that mean? To be halakhically viable? So what does that mean?
Either way.
Does that mean that any individual can make up their mind? Right? If I have two halakhically viable positions in the world, does that mean that at that point all lay people can just flip dice? Flip a coin and if it's heads, I pop to my this viable position. So if you have more than two viable positions, right, roll a dice. Position three.
No, you're halakhic decisor has to decide.
Ah, so viable only for a post-game.
Yes, and then everybody has to have their perspective, right?
Uh-huh. So what do you want to say,
David? It's more like each opinion is intellectually honest and follows, and the path to which these opinions were reached are halakhically viable. Like they follow the legitimate halakhic path, and the sources they rely on and the arguments they make are good arguments. But I guess intellectually honest is the best way of saying it.
Who needs to hear this? Right. So you can make up your own minds, and lay people, apparently, you're telling me, don't get a voice, so who needs to hear this?
And they don't get a voice because, but you need to hear that, you know, your position isn't the only one that's okay. Yours is not the only Torah true position. That's the point.
You know, some lay people whose posting costume the other way, they should be aware of the other lay people who are relying on different posting are relying on some team who are calling out in the vital position.
Yeah, well, they, well, why not?
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. Interesting read, yeah?
I think you should say that. Even though we're going to clearly advocate for one position, we're not saying this is the only correct position. We're just saying this is a position that should be taken for extra halachic reasons.
Aha, so we'll have to play that out. Okay. Does your name throw you in the light of the front bed more soon? Yeah, we'll get there in a moment. We'll get there in a minute. Right. This remains though, even in light of the findings of the President of the Council of Bioethics in 2008, the PRCA papers based on this chart, which basically, you know, here I'll get my own hand, which basically said there was a time when people thought that brain death was death because there was no activity going on in the brain at all. The President's Commission showed that was not true. There is activity going on in the brain. In particular, the hypothalamus usually survives, or often survives. The question is, the hypothalamus survives as an endocrine, part of the endocrine system, not a part of the nervous system, and there are pockets of electrical activity in the brain after brain death. That seems indisputable now. So you have to take those into account. Given that he thinks that this stuff is still viable. Okay. So now we have a makoket aposkin able to able to write even down for all. Right? So everybody should be able to either just ask your aposkin. Right? Or flip a coin.
Or say what we say, but understand the limitations.
Okay. So now here's what everyone says. In regards to this long-standing debate and its critical implications for organizations, we affirm our position that brain death is not a new term. Brain stem death is a halakhically operational definition of death. Yeah, what does halakhically operational mean as opposed to, right? What does it mean as opposed to viable? They already said it was viable. What does it mean to be operational?
That it can be implemented in real life.
Aha. So it's not just a theoretical position. It's an actual position. As such, organs may be removed for transplantation under strict halakhic supervision and guidance. That, of course, is a little bit circular because you have to find the person. You have to find the person who says, okay, he's right. Okay, but now here we get to the Christ, the really key thing. In light of the serious moral issues and profound life-saving potential presented by the possibility of organization, we strongly recommend that rabbis who are rendering decisions for their laity on this matter, okay, so now we're addressing rabbis who are posturing for a laity, demonstrate a strong predisposition to accept the halakhic view of the only supposed to be defined the moment of halakhic death together with brain stem death, or that they refer their lady to rabbis to do so. Now, this is a fascinating paragraph. Because there are Linda Lushitato, I should say, Linda is a dear friend of mine. I think, you know, that I thought this was a beautifully written demonstration of his position. Lushitato, he doesn't want to tell his students that they have to talk to him like him, because that would be imposing Rosh Hashiva's talk on Torah, and centralizing authority and all that, would undo everything he's trying to accomplish. So, there is no attempt made to issue a stock here. On the level of stock, what we have here is the only stock he issues is that he affirms that if you want to talk in this way, you can. Don't be intimidated by the other people. Right, but then he says, we're talking to rabbis. Now, what does it mean to tell a rabbi is posturing for their layperson, and what they're supposed to tell their layperson is that they have a strong predisposition. What kind of stock is that? I have a strong predisposition.
Well, that means, predisposition means over a majority of cases. So you don't have to tell everybody the same thing.
Uh-huh.
But in general, this is what you should do.
So rabbis should flip weighted coins.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little odd. I think
that he's saying that when he gets asked this, he should go in, and then he's thinking about what interviewers give, that when he... While
he's
in the process of thinking about it, he could already be meaning for it.
The other, these arguments are things that should weight your decision heavily towards a side, which I'm not going to say is my side, but, you know.
Demonstrate is an interesting term. To demonstrate it. Now, you have to have a strong predisposition, but to demonstrate a strong predisposition. Yeah.
It doesn't make it terribly clear that this is what he's trying to say.
Yeah.
But it doesn't make sense to say this isn't a met a lot of questions, a lot of questions.
Yeah.
Issues in halakha where it's expected that you're going to try to find a certain outcome. And if that happens an issue among there, you try to find a way that they're not among there.
So like my saying.
Right. So do you say it makes sense to that, remember this is what you're saying, it could make sense to say, because it's an issue of people like Nefesh, you should lean towards the side of the last bit.
Aha. I think it's an issue of people like Nefesh both ways, though, for the problem.
But he disagrees, because he says profound life-saving potential.
Yes, then profound life-saving potential also. Yeah.
You could also make the argument, just like what he's saying, that choosing to be the order donation statistically is much more successful than leaving it in, leaving whatever it is.
Well, not statistically, bring that back.
Well, since
you maximize
an alpha life?
No one is coming out of brain death.
That's right.
So,
reality
is...
This is a deep question.
No, also, if you...
But call me Dratim, this is absolute principle in the Gemara. You're not allowed to heal by killing other people.
But also, if a community says that for religious reasons they are not going to accept brain death and therefore they won't be able to donate their organs, so then the rest of the country may be like, since you will not donate organs and no one from your community can't get organs, so then it would be a deterrent message for all the potential people who need organs in that community.
It was already true of Israel. Removed from international organ donation list because they don't give enough to
them. They can't do it in the U.S. Can't do it in the U.S. so they're unconstitutional. To deprive members of regular groups of organizations because they don't donate. I've already read it, being able to see where they don't donate, you can't do it in the U.S.
Discrimination.
Right to life, liberty, and
inclusion.
People should have an ethical difficulty accepting organs
to save themselves. Yeah, sure. We'll talk about that in a moment.
I don't know. It's very unlikely that I'm ever going to donate an organ because it's unlikely that I'm going to get into a certain accident in which I'm placed in a situation where I'm going to donate an organ. There's a lot more situations where I would receive an organ.
But
you're taking a position that says that I do not donate organs on principle. And then take an organ.
Yeah, how struck on the money, though. That's what it comes
to. Okay, good. We'll get to that. How do you react to the claim rabbis are asked to shalom about their laity should refer their laity to rabbis who paskin this way, even if they don't paskin that way themselves?
No. I think that's okay.
Even if you agree with one point of view, but to refer yourself to different postkin, because you should demonstrate a strong predestined position
at all. I'll tell you a story. When I was a freshman in college, so he came in and he presented to us, as if it were live, actually, I think it had actually happened some years before, that he had been asked to take sex abortion in China. Now, same-sex abortions at that time were famously a dispute between the Sitzeliezer, or the Oldenburg, the Paskin that same-sex abortions were Lutzer. We can talk about this other point. The problem is that he also Paskin that Down syndrome abortions were Lutzer. So I think my tendency to talk to him like the same-sex children went down a lot when I discovered the Down syndrome abortion. When I actually had a shadow of Lutzer, I tried to find a way to check the Paskin on grounds other than the Sitzeliezer, because it was very scary to me. But at that point, all the people knew that the Sicilians were allowed Down syndrome, allowed same-sex abortions, and Moshe Feinstein banned same-sex abortions. So William came and he said, look, asking the child, like, "Who am I?" And the answer is not here. The question is asking about that. I don't think I'm capable of making a decision on this, but then there's asking the silly answer. I had exposure to this kind of stuff in a very, so now what I think,
well, I don't know, what he wrote is different than what he would say to each person. He said, like, it's possible, so, like, I would allow it, but it doesn't mean I recommend it for each person.
Yeah.
It's like a very hesitant.
So it's still answer.
Yeah.
Well, my sister just thought abortion was dravah. It was not so easy. It wasn't a very high bar to not here. But I'm interested in what Lulik is saying, right? So is this honest or not honest? So the way I understand it is that there are times when you feel that there is a right answer, but you feel that you don't have the authority to issue the right answer. Because you have to do what you think is right, and what you have the authority to do. Right? So Lulik, I think, was saying, you know what, it would be a chutzpah for me to make a decision. But making a decision of whom else they should ask, right? So somebody has to make a decision of whom they're going to ask. Right? Why shouldn't it be me? Right? Why should I really flip a coin? Is that really the right thing? Now, I think the realist, I read the, I haven't asked about this, but I can't tell you if I'm getting this right or not. I read the demonstrated strong predisposition more the way I think Eitan read it originally, which is that I think, here's the way I read the statement. I think that, I'm just saying as follows. You're a Reshul Rebbe, you asked me for 2 years ago. Right? There's a tremendous dispute among great poskim. And the truth is, we should be, frank, that as the time this controversy came out, people would have thought that in America, the overwhelming preponderance of great poskim were against Brenda. I think the way that shifted somewhat, that I can only quote dead Israelis. And the way that shifted now, in response to the RCA papers, now, for example, Rav Nachman Rabinovich, as Rashid Amalia Damim, has caused to be sent out for Yeshiva a letter encouraging every student to sign up for donations. I think that a lot more people have signed up. I think the RCA actually interestingly galvanized the opposition more than strengthening the anti-Brenda approach. If that was the goal, I don't think it. But I think Andrew was just saying, you know what? If you're a Shul Rebbe, you gotta be honest and say you're not competent to make this decision. Right? The claim that based on the halachic evidence, you're going to be able to pass an issue like this, which we're tremendous folk on both sides. No, right? This is an issue which validly leads you at an intellectual stalemate. And so, if somebody comes and asks you a shaila, which is they want a technical, formal halachic answer, you can't give them one. Because all you're doing is putting yourself in on one side of the list, where you won't be noticed on the scale. But he argues, what you can tell them is, I think the right answer is that you should donate, that brain death is actually death. And I don't have the authority to give you that, but first of all, you have the right to make up your own mind. In any case, it's a stalemate. That's what AS case number one. Stalemate, you have the right to make up your own mind. Secondly, I can tell you who to ask if you don't want to make up your own mind. And that's fair because you know what the outcome should be. You just don't have the shoulders to carry it off. So that's a very interesting intermediate position. Now, the response to this is in the Agudah paper, right, it's paragraph 3, which Pernurus Lassami said, which is, for anyone, rabbi or layman, to decide that a perceived outcome, I think that's supposed to be preconceived outcome, should determine what halakhic approach to take is something usually associated with Jewish movements outside of Orthodoxy. Right? So you got it quite unorthodox at the beginning. Right?
Well, I think that's true. The statement they said is true, whether it actually applies to this. But it's because we talk about conservative.
So why is the Agudah follow Rav Moshe Feinstein on non-Orthodox
marriages
and not Rav
Hankin? Well, because he's not still.
I wish they did. Actually, big issue. Finding people who have to make a rush on that is harder to find.
Wait. So they'll tell someone that, he's about to, then they're like, your mom's there?
No, yeah, mom's there is the definition.
No, it's slightly different. It'll say, the person,
They will tell you that the,
that they're his mother was first married to someone else's,
yeah.
And got it, like, they all saw, like,
yeah, that was a much longer conversation. They were probably there. Menashe Klein claims that Hanke didn't hold his position about the Mount Zeres either. Either Hanke says he does. And Rabosha claims that Hanke didn't say that about marriages either. Rabosha claims that Hanke only said it about civil marriages. It's not true either. And nor Hanke, nor Hanke said otherwise. But you can talk, so you can talk about your wishes by controversy. But Agudat claims that halakha is supposed to be, you know, it's supposed to be a pure halakhic process. You can't walk in with what we call rooting interest, right? That's what we're saying. When you can't have rooting interest. Now, Agudat points out correctly that we're kind of, so then how do you ever make it right? If the answer to that is, how do you ever make it right? Well, like, we could always hope to disagree, right? So what do you ever do? Right? So that's an important issue.
Like a friend of
Yeah.
You talked about, like, should your decision be based upon what you think the Constitution legitimately says, or based upon what you think the outcome should be?
Yeah. All serious theories of law have to address, you know, anyone who talks about the nature of the role of the judge has to talk about the extent to which equity or justice can influence your outcome.
But they're disinterested, that's why they're post-good. Because they're just interested in their customer, and they know the others. I mean, you know, they're able
to... It doesn't have to be so cynical.
It's cynical.
So let me ask you, so we might want to argue that, here we have a difference between Monorethodox stock and Sephardic stock, and that Monorethodox stock takes into account extra halakhic moral factors, whereas Sephardic stock thinks halakha is an entirely autonomous, self-contained system. How many of you would think that that statement is some basic reality? One, two, what do you want to say, Tom?
I think that the question of what you classify as an extra halakha.
Yeah, what do you mean by that?
That you're fooling yourself, you think that halakha would take into account the outcome.
Right.
You're determining halakha. You can find an halakhic principle about which arguments should be decided to be made to other mouth meaning. It's not like those were made up by modern Orthodox people, because it was very...
Well, I mean, Rabbi Saul of Egypt talks about that, you know, a lot of people talk about that in the modern Orthodox community, but they're not disinterested that they do have outcomes in mind. That is, I mean, that's a traditional idea.
That's really interesting to me.
They have stories of people, like women bringing their chickens to, like, or just, you know, in the time when people will just go get their chickens checked, and... for the cause of age or something, and they would say that they were poor, so they would just say, yes, yeah, it's kosher.
Even when you're alive.
Yeah, or the men, they're praised for that because they're so concerned and poverty and everything. So it's just not true that they...
That's not like ignoring halakhic values. They're taking another halakhic value.
Their question isn't, I have to go look at my book. Their question is it the person who's gone forward to have to get a new chicken? And they want to have the outcome that he doesn't have to get a new chicken.
The criticism here is not that it's ignoring a lot of doubt. It's not saying that. It's saying to say that a perceived outcome determines what one of these to take. Right? So perceived outcome presumably could, like, have basis in how it got. But you're saying it's not.
Good. I want to make three points. One is, I find this wonderfully ironic. Because in fact, so far as I know, only one theorist in history has taken the position that halakha is uninfluenced by external considerations, and that's Rabbi Soloveitchik. Usually, right, halakhic man is like the only one who's ever remotely considered the possibility. Now, I have reread halakhic man to try and argue that it's not true even in him. The theorists are usually quoted as saying this. And as opposed to this, Chareitim generally are very explicit about their motivation, about their extra halakhic motivations. And the whole notion of Da'at Torah is precisely that some kind of spiritual insight as to what kind of outcome is necessary trumps halakhic argumentation, such that you can't argue on technical halakhic grounds against the stock from a double zero.
That's why I asked at the beginning how you would define halakha, because I think they would define halakha as including Hashkafa, including Das Torah. Das Torah is a halachic category by them. And that's why everybody should follow the Eretz Yisrael.
Yeah, I don't get it.
So if Das Torah was that you should save the lives of the people who are not bringing that over again, then I would be more than
They would say that that's true, but it will never be that way because they have the Das Torah.
You're making their argument really circular, right? That this is an extra halachic value because it doesn't agree with our halacha. I don't think they're being that secular. I think they're actually adopting our mythologic rhetoric in ways that are quite humorous. because I think that this is like diametrically opposed to, and actually a deep irony, I think, that Manorosak stock has been frozen for years. Manorosak tends to be highly uncreative in stock because it has bought into this notion that halakha has to be entirely determined by internal characteristics, and Haredi never bought into that, so they had stock that was determined by external characteristics left and right. I think that's
very obvious why it works like that. Yeah. They're using it right here. They sit here and say, it's usually good, there is reasons that outside of Orthodoxy, not from Orthodox people are really written for a mind. Nobody's accusing them of nothing.
That's right. That's a good excellent sociological explanation.
And it's clear why they bring in. I have,
however, a way of reframing this in a way which I actually like their position better. The position they're taking now, which I think is the traditional non-Orthodox position. So I want to set it up as follows. So the question is, when you make a halachic decision internal to the halachic process, do external considerations such as ethics play a role? Now my argument is they must. There's no such thing as a disinterested halachic decision. You have to reconcile halacha with reasonable outcomes. But I think that what the fairly accused Rebbe are doing here is double counting. Right? Presumably, the only Poskim already took these issues into account when they reached their conflicting Pesachim. The Poskim decided to raise this with this, right, realized that, right, part of that issue was, well, we want, you know, there are people who can live a very long time, right, unconscious, and people who can't live a very long time, and they're going to be unconscious anyway. So part of what's driving them is the notion that we really want people to die, right, waiting for organs that are only coming from people who can never do this Pesachim anyway. And the people who Poskim that brain death is not dead, were among their considerations were, do we really want to be in the condition of choosing among life? Right? So what it is finding is that, I think, and this I think is fair, the religion is double counting. First, you would take all these factors into account in the halakha, and that generates the sandal. And then, having done that, we say, oh, yes, guess what? The ethics get to vote again. Right, after you get a halachic sandal, then you get to vote, right, then you can decide a new thing with the ethics. They fairly think it's cheating. Now, I think our Linda argues that that is cheating for a Posek. But it's not cheating for somebody who's not a Posek who never went through this process. So the real question for him is, if you are not a Posek, or not a good enough Posek, and you cannot make a decision based on halachic grounds, are you entitled to make a decision among halakhic positions that have been determined to be viable on non-halakhic grounds? You're not making a halakhic decision, right? The question is, when you have a halakhic standoff, right, does that, so I'm going to operate, now we'll make a very technical halakhic argument, okay? If you're good yeshiva students, you know, what do you do if you raise a halakhic standoff? What do we call that?
Mahalakhic.
And if you can't decide on a focus, what do we call that? A subject. What do we do in a subject? Well, the rule is Allah says Zeraisa, we go to Kumra. And Allah says Zerabana, we go to Kula. So the fundamental argument here is that Rabbi Lindner says, having presented the issue as generally a classic halakhic case of halakhic doubt, which if you believe that authority is rooted entirely in halakha, should generate a rule that you should follow, that you should either go strictly or weak or leniently or freeze, depending on what the halakhic rule applies. But Lindner says, no, when you generate a halakhic dispute, right, that is irresoluble, lay people get to make up their own mind. It doesn't mean that lay people get to talk to halakha. But once you get to the point that, right, once you get to the point where there is no possible halakhic resolution because both sides are viable, and you're not going to be able to generate one side being unviable or not. So at that point, why should lay people be bound? So a good answer is you have two solutions. You can either follow the rule, or you can pick the pussy.
your usual posting, otherwise it's cheating, it's cheetah shopping, right? And a religious seems to think, and I think that this is a very powerful claim, that when the halakhic authorities hit a standoff, that does not necessarily free the lay people. Maybe it liberates the lay people.
I think what he's telling rabbis,
A, you should tell them, you know what, I can't talk in this, but I think the right thing to do is this, why don't you go do that? And if the lay people say, no, I'm not going to do it unless I have a talk, then find them a post they can tell them that.
I don't think he says that. I think it says that there are actually even asking if it is the right thing to do. Or is to say, I can make this decision. You're going back out, I do it. And we could say, well, you can make up your mind. I'm not going to. And really, it's not
interesting. It's not, so I can't, you know, I can tell you that my listener has a copy of my article in which I argue this way. He hasn't argued with me, but I can't tell you he's read it. I can't prove it. It's interesting.
Yeah. It would be a disaster in terms of political statement for him to go and say, well, it was no longer in the hands of the rabbis because they don't know the answer. Why would they people make up their mind?
You think it would be a disaster politically?
Yeah, they're trying to pull up a statement that's not going to be restricted to a Western crowd.
How could you have a position that once the rabbis don't know what to do with halakha, the lay people get to decide who are less educated and therefore like don't know what they're doing?
Oh, it's a Gemara. The Gemara says that when the rabbis can't make up their mind, what you do is you say, Pukhaza, Mayam Adavar, let's see what the people say.
But I mean, isn't that like the theological argument?
Yes.
But can't you make the claim that Zachamon is talking about where the post can agree that they can? So in this case, usually it's what you would call a cheetah shopping. Because the Gemara, I don't think, was accepting him for the different sheet sales and done no cheetah.
So Eitan refuses to believe that Linder actually said this, and none of the rest of you like it anyway. So this is not our attack stuff, we're in trouble.
And you're trying to say that it's there anyone have attacked on them. They clearly couldn't find that in the argument.
Maybe they couldn't conceive that he would say anything like that. I have to say, Roy has just published a piece in which he argues that the solution for Brenda is that you take the patient off the respirator, you wait till their heart stops, you declare them dead, and then you restart the heart. And then you can take the organs because they're dead anyway.
Is that already too much time?
It's only 30 seconds, heart stop. It doesn't stop irreversibly, it just stops irreversibly autonomously.
Wait, so he's telling people to kill people?
Remove impediments to death is not killing. You can't.
Wait, I don't think you're not allowed to take, I don't know.
He's assuming, according to the position, that you can remove the respirator from a brain dead patient, even though the brain dead patient is not dead. But I'm suggesting you remove the respirator, you wait till their heart stops, you wait till their heart stops for 30 seconds, so now they're dead.
Wow.
But then you restart the heart, because otherwise your organs won't work. Yeah, this is now I have to say, when I first saw this... No, because they're already dead.
Wait, you don't need guys from what?
No, that's right. So, right now, if you're not dead...
It doesn't mean they're going to go
there. Somebody was out there.
So I just mentioned that we can talk about this. This was originally...
But they're brain dead and die when they had a heart attack.
Dr. Robert Shrug... Dr. Robert Shrug of Harvard actually did this as an experiment once in the sort of game famous where he...
Wait, how can you experiment on that?
He ran an experiment with a bunch of children where who unfortunately, from his perspective, were not going to die fast enough of brain death. So their organs were going to deteriorate, so he injected them with a substance that would cause their hearts to stop for long enough for it not to be able to restart it autonomously, at which point he declared them dead. But then he restarted the heart. You couldn't accuse him of murder because all the bodies were the same shape as the veterans, but then he could take the organs because they were dead. That's what everybody's proposing. Now, I just mentioned this because nobody has attacked us for this because nobody believes you wrote it. I just I told him if he released it. Is you think anyone's just listening? I thought, I wrote it clearly. That's how many people can't imagine that he actually said something. He really believes it. It's an interesting position. You'll see. I think something people think is even worse. That's the suggestion I'm going to make Sunday night. People think is even worse. So, far be it for me to... But sometimes you say things that no one... I'm giving a share while you're just the substance to bring it out of the process. So I will also come...
What are you going to say?
I'm going to try and tell an intermediate position also.
I'm not going to...
They'll be on tape. Be part of the 30,000. I don't want to say yet because I may change my mind before this. But in terms of the Edith question, you should be aware that one of the best books to read about, important books to read on this, which my friend over Don Simon's opinion, an anthropologist recommended, is an anthropological book about brain death in the U.S. and Japan. It's called Twice Dead. So not so easy, not so clear. Okay. So the last thing is that at the end, Linzer makes the claim that to adopt a restrictive position regarding donating and a permissive position regarding receiving organs is morally untenable. Now, Aguda points out correctly, last paragraph, no! What must be unequivocally rejected by Jews, at least those who care for Kodesh Torah, are attempts to manufacture halakhic personifications because why? The previous paragraph, that halakhic position held by a majority of major postkin today is derided by the statement as morally untenable. So now we have a second stage debate, which Linzer believes that you can call a position adopted by many great postkin morally untenable. So it's halakhically viable, but morally untenable. And Aguda says you can never call halakhic position adopted by great postkin morally untenable. So here we have another grave debate. Can you reject a legitimate halakhic position arrived at by significant authorities as immoral?
By the Haredim, you can. You just have to say that they're not a real halakhic authority, or you have to say that they don't really hold it. That's what they did with the Synagogue Council of America.
And you can't do it, right? The question is, can you explicitly make that claim?
No, you can't explicitly do it. It's not a real halakhic.
Right. Do you think that it is legitimate? For yourself, do you think it is legitimate to make the claim that a halakhic decision arrived at by plausible halakhic argumentation by people with legitimate halakhic authority is nonetheless morally untenable?
By the modern Orthodox, yes, because I mean that's what they do with the Sufkin controversy. Was a big thing. A lot of people actually acknowledge that pesach is a viable halakhic pesach by the Gedolim. By the Gedolim door because it was arrived at by the Gedolim.
No, but because because you just say that it is derived through like Kitzel and Halakha, but that maybe they weren't taking ethics into account when they did the Halakha. And so now we're taking ethics into account and we find that the ethics and Halakha disagree.
So I think that too. First of all, the question of whether that position is in fact morally untenable is interesting. I agree with Linzer about that language, morally untenable. But I think it's worth thinking about whether it matters what grounds you make the decision on. If you make the ground that a decision is morally untenable because the basis of that position is that most donors are non-Jews, and right, so what's the problem anyway? That's morally untenable. It happens that there's one really creative way of getting to this conclusion, which is to claim that Halakha doesn't assert authority over non-Jews as to what the definition of death is, and they can act on their own definition and you don't have to stop them. Right? That's a much cleverer way of getting to the same conclusion. So why should you stop them? They think he's dead. They're entitled to think he's dead, but I can't donate because I think I'm alive. Right? That's a very interesting way of getting to the same conclusion. It's really interesting whether the judgments of moral untenability are based on the grounds of the argument or on the results of the argument. What I do think is really important, I think that I would be happy if the defining elements of modern stuff were the willingness to reject formal halakhic arguments on the grounds that their conclusions are morally untenable. I'm happy to say, for example, that you know what? There's a reasonable halakhic argument that you can steal from Gentiles, but it's wrong. And so it's not always just the right. You just have to reject that. It's not a halakhic outcome. I think that the capacity to say that is it would be a strength of the community. I think that the also the second issue is whether the authority to say that rests explicitly in the same people who give us our halachic authority to, which is kind of circular. Or whether you vest the authority to make moral judgments about halakha to some extent in the community as well as amongst the folks. That is a big issue, I think, also. Now, there are slippery slope arguments, and it's sort of unfortunate that we have locked ourselves into the notion that making that kind of argument explicitly feels like either conservative Judaism or Haredi Judaism, that modern orthodoxy is the blessed nation where it has to be pristine, and it can't do that. Okay, so I can take questions after this. I guess the summary is, the reality is that most of the claims of what differentiates Haredi and modern orthodoxy are actually not compelling. What really differentiates modern orthodoxy stock right now, at the first level is outcome, which is that modern Orthodox stock, I think, tends to be much more conscious of being situated in a community which sees non-Jews as full members, and sees the notion that you're responsible for passing it away, which is plausible, which is a plausible outcome for everyone in the community. One way, if you want to put it in sharp terms, Aristotle, adopted by Rawls, has this notion of the veil of ignorance. You guys know about this? The system of fairness. Right? Fairness means that you have to make that if you were playing every role in a society, you have to make decisions in such a way that if you don't know which role you play in the society in advance, you would think this is just. Right? So one notion of modern orthodox stuff is...
Right.
Yeah. You don't know, right? That's the economic role, political role. So one question is, right, you know, do you really believe that if you ended up being Gentile as opposed to Jewish, that you would think this stuff was reasonable? Now, part of that, the challenge to the flaw in Aristotle, right, which Rawls tries to correct, is if you believe ontological differences between people. Right, so Aristotle justifies slavery on the grounds that you understand that people who have enslaved mentalities, right, should be slaves. And you would recognize that you have a slavish mentality, you would of course acknowledge in advance that people, you might not realize that if you were actually a slave, but that would be an error because you didn't understand your own mentality. So people would say, right, so you can make a claim, if you think there are ontological differences between Jews and non-Jews, you can make a claim, yes, of course this is the right outcome. So I would be fairly happy if modern orthodox stock ended up working generally on the premise that there isn't an ontological difference between Jews and non-Jews. But here again, one has to be aware that that is a position which is very much not regnant among the religious lines of Israel. And this would actually create a huge split between, right, if modern orthodoxy grounds itself in America, grounds itself on the claim that there's no ontological difference between Jews and Gentiles, then religious line isn't going to be happy doing that. I have to agree that you set up a crisis in the religious lines, but now I think that crisis is over.
Nobody
sees
this as relevant,
but also, there's a lot of, like, minor identities that they call, yeah.
Yes, and disappear.
No, but I don't know. Well, they won't like that.
No, it's just that they have the collective impact on it.
They help teach in
Americans. They help teach in Americans for 1 year. So that is their cynical thing, right? The lifestyle of an Orthodox rabbi. Right? If you go on Aliyah, you become an Israeli and you teach in Americans for 1 year as opposed to 4, which we have done in the States. And then you come back to America as a Torah Mitzvah, right? Back there Israeli, teaching Americans. Exactly the way you would have if you hadn't done an Aliyah. All right, now certainly the next stage is that you go back and you become head of Israeli, you're not just teaching, you become head of the Israeli Jews for Americans.
Why do you have 9 or 10%?
You could found
organizations to help people
with conversion. Oh, yes, you can be Dr. Seth Farber, you know, who's the shining exception to all this, who I'm glad will be coming to Sharon and doing.
Oh, cool. Oh, I'm here.
Two weeks? Oh, yeah, Sharon, I don't know if you're kind of brand new. You should get it.
Well, we can make it. You're not sitting here in 2 weeks.
Yes, we will.
My
turn of the disillusionment occurred when Neymar started years ago by Rav Amital and our listeners being of the non-Orthodox alternative to religious Zionist party. It was a very interesting platform, both for us as a religious party that believes in religion as relevant to politics. didn't have mass appeal, but we thought it would have mass appeal, and then we got slightly fewer votes, I think, than the party of taxi drivers. that kind of failed to convince me that the best of American Orthodox was having a deep impact on Israeli society. I've been having a series of conversations on Saturday night. I had a conversation with David Stubb, the founder of Tohar, and asked Dr. Adam Furlinger of the American Alliance does the sociology of these issues. I'm going to have a little bit further in a couple of weeks. But if you're interested, I'm trying to explore this question, is there modern Orthodox in Israel? If it is, what is it? My take is, I guess here's another, I don't think we have a modern Orthodox stock yet. I don't think we have a methodology for it. I don't think we have agreed upon outcomes, right? And let alone do we have an explanation of how the methodology leads to outcomes. And part of the issue we have is the lack of confidence is that if we actually defined them, then we wouldn't be right on orthodoxy. And because modern orthodoxy right now, I think correctly, accepts the notion that orthodoxy as a movement is the sole and representative of Orthodox Judaism. So we sort of acknowledge that if we got rid out of the Orthodox community, especially we lose all our authority. Ourselves. We wouldn't see ourselves, right?
We're not worried about, data problems.
Can we say that we're orthodox and they're not?
If we have the confidence, right? If we really believe that, then, we could try it and see if we won.
But it wouldn't win. I mean, we'd win for a certain population.
No,
because we're trying to beat everybody and we're losing everywhere. As opposed to beating, winning for a certain population, saying, we're right, we're going to tell you the position.
If you say that you're, so just, defining your stock as modern Orthodox, a different kind of Orthodox stock from, Clarity Orthodox stock, so how can people be Orthodox when you have a different kind of stock? How do you make a modern Orthodox
stock
and stay
worth it?
So we have.
Animals are created equal, some are better than others.
So look how, so I am.
The very important word in our
story. Well, in modern Orthodoxy, it's a very important word. In Haredi Orthodoxy, they say you're Orthodox. That means you're straight. You have to be Torah true.
You see, that their rhetoric is also unorthodox. Is it unorthodox other movements? Orthodoxy is still a big deal.
But I think the reason they're using that word is to play, saying, if you're,
in this position,
you're not the English.
Yes, that's true, and we care.
You're asking yourself
if
you're Orthodox.
Right, and we care about our self-definition. I think we're not there yet. I think that what I'm trying to show is that actually we have a certain tension because probably my Orthodox stock requires taking values into account, but we have a philosophic tradition which opposes that. Mm-hmm.
A philosophical tradition which opposes that?
Yeah, which is the majority of Olympic.
When you talk about Soloveitchik, I mean, you were talking about Halachic men, but elsewhere he talks differently. He says, I don't want to say certain things. He says, I have outcomes in mind. The other thing is Rabbi Rachman, Rabbi Wurzburger. I mean,
I understand. We have a philosophical tradition. I think it's a misunderstanding of Halachic men as well. I've long lecture on this also. But I think you have to be acknowledged that the rhetorical influence of that understanding of Rabbi Soloveitchik in the modern Orthodox community is tremendous. You can find the exact same rhetoric comes from Y.U.R.F. Yeshiva, it comes from Yehuda's statement.
Do you think all that really comes from Soloveitchik, or do you think some of it comes from the fear of becoming not Orthodox?
I think Rabbi Soloveitchik, I think that understanding Rabbi Soloveitchik had tremendous appeal for good reasons, right, for particular reasons in honor of the West State, and we really need to get past it. But I think you have to acknowledge it. It's not like you can claim the honor of the, you can have a reaction on, that we were on it, but you have to acknowledge that most of the rabbis who've been identified as, for example, Rosh Yeshiva and Moshe, have taken the opposite position, so the claim you have a tradition that way, that's what honor of the stock is a hard thing to claim, because that's not the way.
When you say modern orthodoxy, I mean, you're including the YU Rosh Yeshiva generally. Rabbi Yitzchak Cohen is modern orthodoxy.
Yeah, I think that's how we define it. I think Rabbi Moshefter is unquestionably modern orthodoxy. Whether that is the honor orthodoxy you wish to be, but you can listen to him. I listened to a share of his for an hour the other day on tape, and he said 15 things that we've gotten thrown out of already. It started with the presumption that everybody has to go to college. to start with, everybody has to go to college, right? And then, right? Women have to have careers.
Where's Burns?
They have to finish, they have to finish college. Like, you know, left and right, all sorts of things.
Let's get some nervous.
Obviously, we're not superstitious like the people in Europe were. Right? Statement after statement is quite stunning. So you should read the interview with Emma Bachelor last year, which is way less than me on all sorts of issues. Chester's quite, you know, quite matter of fact. Whether you're exact, part of the ocean is, you know, but here's the bonus claim. Movements are coalitions. And what coalitions are people agreeing to sacrifice things that they think are less important in order to agree on things that are more important, right? You have log cabin Republicans. You know, the Republican Party is largely aligned with you know, conservative social policies, but there's a lot of Canadian Republican groups because they need votes, right? And you have pro-life Democrats, right? Because every party will tolerate people in its wing, and generally what happens is you build a coalition because you need to oppose the other side. If you win, the coalition splinters. Right? So if you recognize on our state right now, there's a coalition, and that coalition includes people who with vastly different positions about the nature of halakha, about the role of women, about the nature of the state. Right? It's quite astounding to have an Orthodox is an astounding coalition, which right now Orthodox is a coalition that includes people who think that the state is messianic and that the state is satanic. Right? We have both groups that call the same movement who think that the most important event in Jewish history in the past thousand years, right, is either messianic or satanic, and we live together. Right? That's quite astounding. I live here, you know, I'm a modern Orthodox rabbi who won't say she's be talking about things. People live with that. Right? Because I don't want to say be messianic, although I am a religious Zionist. So I think, you know, then with the Orthodox coalition, the notion that Zionism is not as important an issue as Lafayette process is quite astounding. It's quite astounding, and we're going to find out pretty soon. You know, we're finding out right now whether Halakhic authority, right, do we include the independent Mishitim Yemenim as part of Orthodoxy or not? Or is the Shura Chadashim Muslim part of Orthodoxy or not? Maybe yes, maybe not. That's a political question, right, which will ask. Even if it's included, it doesn't mean that 90% of the Orthodox movement won't reject it. And even if it's included, the way it will be included is by the right 50% ignoring them, right? And the 10% closest to them walking them in, and the right 50% not throwing the 10% that welcomes them in out. Right? That's how the coalitions are built. So I think that Orthodox is a very important term, but it's a political term. There's no reason to believe that everything that is Orthodox is right, and there's no reason to believe that everything that is right is included in Orthodoxy. Right? Just right now, you can't take the right decisions that aren't Orthodox and be included in the Halakhic community. And I'm okay with that. So you have to make decisions about that. Okay, so I just hope I haven't gotten great clarity. You should be aware, I guess, that my summer program has been working on trying to answer this question for 14 years now. And among others, as opposed to trying to answer this question, as far as they're just trying to build a community of people who think the question matters. And if we're going to have an honorable thought, the first thing we have to do is have a lot of Amir Kahanim, who share the presumptions of what halakha ought to be, such that you can begin to start thinking about what your common methodology is. Which happily, you know, you remember, but that's what I remember it Monday night, so I'm glad that my program seems to be having some impact. that you can exist in environments where there are some things like that. And so I hope that you will either, if you are capable of learning, then you should apply. If you have friends who are capable of learning, you should make them apply. And if you're not capable of learning and all your friends are on the IR, and you can listen to the story yourself on the website and convince your uncle. That's just important. Everyone has their own movement. Yes, that's it.
Do you need to call
it program? Any program.
Thank you, Russell. What are you going to say on Sunday?
Now we'll talk.